Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, this is your guest host, Beatrice Russo, and in this episode, I have the privilege of bringing you my most recent conversation with physicist Brian Miller at the Center for Science and Culture's summer seminar that took place in Seattle. I caught up with Brian shortly after his lecture, and here's our conversation. Dr. Miller, you talked about the origin of life and evidence of intelligent design in regards to that. Would you please give us a summary of your talk and some just highlight points?
Certainly. What I talked about is when you look at the origin of life, one of the biggest challenges is the thermodynamic challenges. Namely, if you look at the natural processes you see in chemistry and physics, they always tend to go from a state of low entropy to high entropy. That's like going from order to disorder. Or they tend to go from a state of high energy to low energy. That's like water freezing. Or both. And what happens is the origin of life, you have to go to both a state of lower entropy and to a state of higher energy. That's physically impossible. That never happens spontaneously unless you have some outside help, like with a machine. And this is often combined into what's called the free energy. So the free energy combines both the change of entropy in a process and the change of energy. And all natural processes will go from high free energy to low free energy. So basically summarizing what I said, the origin of life requires going from low free energy to high free energy, which is something that is physically impossible. In fact, there was a professor named Harold Morowitz who calculated the odds of some pool of chemicals becoming like a bacterial cell. And he said the chance of that happening would be like 1 in 10 to the power of a billion, or even for E. coli, it would be like 100 billion. And the reason for that is because of the enormous amount of energy that you have to absorb from the environment to change that system into such a high free energy state. And the equivalent would be like a bathtub of water absorbing enough heat spontaneously to start to boil if it's room temperature. I also talked about the only way to get around this challenge is what life does. And that's essentially to use machinery to process energy. That's sort of like the metabolic cycles in organisms, which will process sugar and turn that into ATP, or photosynthesis. So you have to have these engines in place that can convert one form of energy into a form that's useful for the cell. And two, you've got to have information to direct that energy in such a way that actually creates the order that you want, or the order that maintains a stable cell. And that information is actually an enzyme. So enzymes are very complex molecules, proteins, which essentially force the right chemical reactions to take place in cells such that cells can live. So this whole issue of the origin of life requires that you have pre-existing information and advanced machinery to allow life to exist.
So it sounds like you have to have a complex system to come together and kind of know how to come together in order to even exist.
Yeah, exactly. So you really hit the nail on the head, because what happens is the origin of life requires taking chemicals and bringing them into a very complex state, which isn't just simply complex, but a very specific complex state. So there's been engineers who've thought about what are the minimum requirements for self-replication, like engineers at NASA who are thinking about self-replicating space probes. And also there's been biologists looking at what's the simplest that a cell can become and still function. So if the cell were any simpler, it would simply, metabolism would cease and eventually it would break down to simple chemicals. And these two studies have converged. So what you see is if you want to have a cell that can self-replicate, you've got to have information processing, energy production, manufacturing, autoassembly. You've got to have control systems. You've got to have feedback loops. So you have to have this incredibly complex molecular machinery in place, because if you're missing even one element, a simple cell is going to stop functioning and head right back towards equilibrium or simple chemicals. So essentially the problem with the origin of life is you've got to take simple chemicals and move it into an incredibly complex and specific state that meets all these requirements, which is also of extremely high free energy. And that is something that requires a mind. How do I know? Well, let's use an analogy. If you ever seen the movie Contact, it's a movie about this signal that came from outer space, and the signal was detected and it contained the schematics of a spaceship, encoded information. And they built the spaceship and it would actually function. In the same way, the simplest possible cell requires that you have to have enormous amounts of information in the proteins, the enzymes, and in DNA, which is needed to replace the enzymes when they break, because you have to keep replacing these proteins. And the capacities of a cell are similar to that of a automated vessel. So in no other context, if you encountered some sort of nanotechnology that was capable of information processing, energy production, et cetera, would you have the slightest doubt that you're dealing with design, because you're seeing evidence of foresight, coordination, goal direction. And in the same way, when you look at the requirements for the simplest possible cell, you see undeniable evidence of design, or that it originated from a mind.
So it sounds like having a random assembly of these parts sounds like it's not even possible.
Most origin of life researchers would acknowledge that there's no chance a cell could come together just through random operations, just by chance. They recognize that it's just too improbable. Like, there is some research papers done that looked at the number of possible interconnections that enzymes or proteins could have in a cell. And the number was astronomical. It was like 1 in 10 to the power of like 60, 90 million for a simple, like a simple fungi cell. So again, if you're looking at the simplest possible cell, which would be something like a bacteria, it might be a few orders of magnitude smaller, but nevertheless, the number of possible ways you could have chemical reactions taking place is just absolutely astronomical. There's no chance you're going to get that purely by chance. In fact, even origin of life researchers like Orgel have commented that you'll never get a functional metabolism just by chance. So again, you have to have lots of information in your enzymes to force the right chemical reactions for the cell to function. So there must be enormous amounts of information beforehand. And you're talking about like a megabit of information for that at the absolute minimum. So again, you're seeing undeniable evidence of so much information that had to pre-exist a cell that you have to deal with the mind.
Plus, we have entropy that doesn't really help that random process.
Well, that's a great point. What happens is that if you have a cell and you're missing just a few components, what's going to happen is the metabolism will shut down, and then the thermodynamic forces of nature will cause that cell to basically decompose and turn back into lower free energy chemicals. So that's why a cell has to originate within just a few seconds, like almost instantaneously. Because if you, let's say, get 95% the way to a cell, and then you stop pushing it, you stop intelligently directing it, it will move right back towards equilibrium. It'll simply break apart. So that's why you have to go from basic chemicals directly to a cell in an instant, because if you don't, nature is going to push it in the opposite direction.
So I wanted to ask you, how do we know that something is design?
Well, the issue of how do you tell if something's design really goes back to the idea of design detection methods. And perhaps the best one was produced by Bill Dembski, which is his design filter. And he determined that if you want to determine if some pattern is designed, you ask three questions. The first question is this pattern produced by some natural process? Like if you see a crystal, you might have a geometric shape because of the natural electrostatic attractions of the molecules. So that would not be designed because it's simply the product of a natural process. A similar would be like little waves on the beach due to the wind and the tides. The second question you ask is, if it's not produced by natural process, is it highly improbable? In other words, does it demonstrate a lot of complexity? So for instance, if you have a bowl of soup and you look in the soup and you see your name and your name is Bob, that doesn't demonstrate clear evidence of design because the word Bob is not that improbable. It's not that complex. So it's something that could be explained purely by chance. However, if you're looking at a bowl of soup, alphabet soup specifically, and you see a sentence, like the Declaration of Independence, the first sentence of the Declaration of Independence, what you have here is something that's, one, not the process of a natural law, because the chemistry of pasta will not produce sentences. It's something that's highly complex because it's an entire sentence. It's really improbable. But finally, it shows specificity or specified complexity because it demonstrates a pattern that points beyond itself. So a sentence, a readable sentence, is a pattern which is external to the actual physics and chemistry of the soup. So again, if it's not a natural process, if it's something highly improbable, and it shows specificity or specified complexity, then you can be very confident that that pattern is designed.
Thank you. You were talking about if you build in your search the end goal of your search, then the search is successful. Can you expand a little bit more on that and that concept?
Certainly. And the context was they were computer scientists that created evolutionary algorithms. And these were essentially search algorithms that attempted to find certain targets. And what they did is they would produce certain patterns or certain results that they would say were innovative and that demonstrated the power of evolution to create something novel. Well, when you look at these algorithms like the Alveda search process, the programmers built into the search process the end goal that they wanted. So what happens is if you have any sort of search process with any sort of fitness terrain, you'll never get anything interesting unless you build into the search process the end goals that you want. So these evolutionary algorithms did not show the power of evolution, but they showed its limitations unless an intelligent agent was feeding information into the system.
Okay. Wanted to ask you more on the challenges that you see in today's culture, the challenges academics or students face in academia. Do you have any comments on that?
The challenges that the students face in the academy, and even professors, even tenured professors, is really significant because what happens is the de facto faith of the secular academy, most universities in the United States and Europe and beyond, is that of what's called scientific materialism, or some people will simply say it's philosophical materialism. It's the idea that all that we see in the universe, the matter, the energy, space and time, that's all that exists, that there is no higher intelligence involved in the world. And maybe even if there were an intelligence that created the world, like a deistic view of a creator, that creator would not be involved in the world. So that means that when you do science, you can't argue that you see positive evidence for design. That's considered heretical. So if you present that view, you will face a lot of persecution. You'll face a lot of harassment. People will pressure journals not to publish your articles. So it's enormously difficult. So what happens is people that believe in design have to be very wise on how they present their views. So many people believe in design, and it'll guide their research. So that intuition will actually help them to do better research, but they'll be fairly quiet about the fact that there is design, except for their closest colleagues whom they trust. Other researchers will be more open. That would be people like Michael Behe, people like Bill Dembski. They'll be very open that the design is real and it's detectable and it's scientific, but then they'll face enormous amounts of backlash. A lot of people that misrepresent them, that'll attack them, that'll accuse them of being pseudoscientists. So it's extremely challenging. So the difficulty is, how do you actually present the truth in the academy? And people have to decide very carefully in what ways they're going to do that. Are they willing to take the persecution? Or do they want to be more quiet and simply allow the design intuition to advance their research, which is what the majority of people do?
Okay. What would you tell to a young audience as far as maybe high school students preparing for college? What would be the best piece of advice that you would have for them? Maybe the people that are considering natural sciences or pursuing something within biology or even physics, which is a subject that you have studied.
Yeah, the challenge is basically the academy will offer acceptance to people of faith, people that might be Christian or Jewish or even other faiths, if they essentially embrace an intellectual captivity. They have to basically suppress any evidence they see of design and nature, just pretend it's not there, and they have to accept scientific materialism and simply only try to explain the world according to the laws of physics and simple processes like that. So the challenge is to retain the right to think critically, to retain the right to pursue truth, to not just blindly accept what you're told, but always ask, what's the evidence behind it? Always listen to the other side. What I've done for like 30 years is I've looked at one set of arguments by the design proponents. I'd look at the critics, how they respond to those arguments. I look at how the design proponents respond to the responses of the critics. And what I find is that the criticisms are typically very superficial and misleading. And what happens is they simply ignore the responses of the design proponents to those critics. So the challenge is to always think critically and keep looking at both sides of the argument so you can really see where the truth is. And then also be very wise about how you pursue your career. You'll just, again, have to be very savvy about what you say, when you say it, what research you want to pursue. Because, again, some research fields, if you're an engineer, it's not a big deal. You can talk about design in biology or in physics without too much trouble. Other research fields like biology or psychology can be much more challenging. So just be aware of the challenges and think beforehand how you'll position yourself and what you're going to have to face.
Thank you, Dr. Miller. And one last question would be, if you were to summarize the best evidence for intelligent design in a couple of points, what are the top main points for that?
Well, when you're looking for the evidence for intelligent design, you can go to physics and you can see how the laws of nature seem to have been designed with life in mind. You can see the extraordinary design in our planet, our sun, how so many factors have to be just right for life to exist. So there's kind of the big picture, cosmological, scientific laws of physics type evidence. In biology, I think with the origin of life, is we're very clear evidence of design because, again, in order for life to exist, you have to have complex machinery. You have to have lots of information in your proteins, in your DNA, and feedback loops. So I would say the issue of the information in life is one of the strongest pieces of evidence for design. Also, what's happening is people are recognizing that as you study biology, it shows more and more clear evidence of the principles of engineering. So what you're seeing is this convergence between biology and engineering and systems biology. So the fact that you're seeing how life is using design logic, which is the very same logic used in engineering, is incredibly powerful evidence of design because, one, engineers have enormous experience with things like feedback loops, control systems, top-down design of machines, and they know that this cannot happen by a gradual incremental process because you have to have the overall goal in mind. You then have to design the whole system in its entirety, and then you have to manufacture it from the bottom up. That it requires, again, foresight, coordination, and goal direction. So that is, again, another very powerful evidence for design.
Right. Thank you. Really enjoyed hearing your points here. Thank you, Dr. Miller, for your time.
For ID the Future, this has been Beatrice Russo. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.